This is Where We Live from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalbathanchel. More than a decade ago, the city of New Haven was one of the first American cities to create a resident ID card with the intent of sending a message to undocumented immigrants that they're welcome to live in the Elm City. But even in the 1990s, other cities in the U.S. began implementing informal practices to help immigrants integrate. Coming up, we'll talk with Trinity Professor Abigail Fisher-Williamson about her research into several municipalities that enacted policies to accommodate immigrants. What have been the effects? We'll find out. First, attention on the nation's immigration system largely centers on the southern border. Most recently, President Trump's desire to build a border wall has led to the longest federal government shutdown in U.S. history, 34 days and counting. But there have been other immigration policy changes that have occurred during his time in office. Today, we're going to focus on some of them and ask experts if these challenges have done anything to fix an immigration system that has been called broken for decades. Now, do you support the president's actions? Tell us why or why not by joining the conversation, 860-275-7266. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. I want to welcome our first guest into the studio, Cara Hart, Associate Attorney for Leet, Costo, and Wisner, LLP. That's an immigration law firm in Hartford. Cara, welcome to our show.
Good morning. Thank you, Lucy.
I should say you've been an immigration attorney for many years. I'm curious, when we talk about the immigration system, much attention on undocumented immigrants in the U.S. What is the reality when we think about people who are living here illegally? Are they coming up from the southern border, or are there other avenues that they've taken to stay here?
Well, it's difficult to say with absolute certainty how many people have come through the southern border, but certainly a number of other people have entered the United States with temporary permission, some sort of a what we refer to as a non-immigrant visa, and perhaps have either overstayed or violated the terms of those visas. So although I think people, as you mentioned, imagine that all undocumented individuals in the United States have entered without permission, that's really not the case.
We have some statistics from the Department of Homeland Security that say that about 700,000 travelers to the U.S. overstayed their visas in fiscal year 2017. And then during the same year, there are about 300,000 apprehensions along the southern border, which, again, gets a lot of attention in the news. When we think about the system in place, Cara, to handle people coming into our country, it's divided up between three different agencies. Could you explain the particular agencies and what the responsibilities are?
Sure, Lucy. When the Department of Homeland Security was created back in the early 2000s, the functions of what was previously called the Immigration and Nationality Service, INS, were divided into three separate service and enforcement agencies. So ICE, which stands for Immigration and Customs Enforcement, is the agency that's in charge with enforcing our immigration laws inside the United States. Customs and Border Protection, also referred to as CBP, is responsible for examining people when they come through our ports of entry, whether it's at our land borders or in airports. They also patrol within 100 miles of our land borders. And the third agency is United States Citizenship and Immigration Services, USCIS. This was the agency that was created as the benefits-granting part of the immigration bureaucracy. So they consider and process requests for benefits like green cards, work authorization, and naturalization.
We are focusing in on some of the policy changes that have happened over the last 2 years under the Trump administration that aren't getting a lot of attention. When we think about the responsibilities of these three specific agencies, have their responsibilities changed at all over the 2 years?
Yes. In fact, they have. Should mention a fourth agency that also plays a role in our immigration bureaucracy is our Department of State, which will consider applications for visas when people are applying from outside the United States. And since Trump was inaugurated, over the past 2 years, we've seen a steady succession of policies that affect all of the agencies that have any bearing on how immigration laws and policies are enforced.
I understand the mission change for a specific agency. Was that Citizenship and Immigration Services? And what was the change, Cara?
Yes, that's right. About a year ago now, United States Citizenship and Immigration Services changed its mission statement. So it removed any reference to our being a nation of immigrants, as well as references to customer service. In essence, I think it signaled a shift in attitude and in priorities of what was designed to be and set up to be a benefits-granting agency. Now by all accounts, plays a larger role in immigration enforcement, perhaps, than in the past.
You've mentioned bureaucracy a couple of times. When we hear the word bureaucracy, we think often of a system that takes a long time to get work done, given the fact that there have been changes and now this federal shutdown that's going on for 34 days. How has the system been further burdened, so to speak?
Well, I think the greatest burden has fallen on our immigration courts, which fall under another agency, the Department of Justice. So the immigration courts are really only at this point able to handle matters for individuals who are detained, so who are in immigration detention, which means that anybody else who may be in a removal proceeding, even with the option or the possibility of gaining a permanent benefit at the end of it, such as an asylee, those cases are not being attended to during the shutdown. The other agencies, such as USCIS, are still operating because they are fee-based and are funded by the fees that applicants pay.
Coming up, we're going to talk more about immigration courts with John Bauer, who's clinical professor of law at UConn Law School. But I wanted you, Cara, to walk us through some of the policy changes that haven't gotten a lot of attention. When President Trump was first elected, a lot of attention on the ban on certain Muslim countries. But I'm curious, when we think about refugees that are trying to come in, whether from the southern border or from overseas, how have those numbers changed?
Well, refugee admissions are cut in about half in the past year. And that's been a conscious decision by the administration to admit fewer refugees. There have also been other changes with respect to vulnerable populations who may be eligible for humanitarian benefits, such as DACA holders. The administration is still working to end that program.
So this is the young people deferred action under the Obama administration that would have some kind of status to work that has been put on hold or ended under President Trump.
Yes. There are several legal challenges working their way through the appellate courts to DACA. So for the time being, the agency is still renewing benefits for people who already hold them. But that's one example. Another example, of course, we've seen the efforts to end temporary protected status, TPS, for certain countries. And again, refugee admissions are sharply down.
This is Where We Live. Cara Hart in studio with me. She's an immigration attorney with Lead Costo and Wisner. As we take some time to delve into our very large and many people would say broken immigration system, if you have a question about how our immigration system functions, again, so much attention on whether border security should be strengthened along our southern border, but there's a lot of different avenues for people to come into this country, and there's legal statuses that people try to get, such as green cards and eventually their citizenship. There's many different visas that the U.S. government hands out to people so that they have some type of status in this country. It's very complicated, and so that's why we're doing the show. But you can join us, too, 860-275-7266. What about high-skilled immigration visas? What has been the guidance from the Trump administration on the types of visas that are given to people who are trying to come here, whether to work at a university or to work for a highly skilled job?
Well, under what was called the Buy American, Hire American directive from the Trump administration, they really made processing of these visas much more difficult and put much more an emphasis on trying to prove, and unfairly so in my opinion, that an American worker couldn't possibly do this job. They've also implemented policies that affect the processing of applications that have in the past been approved based, again, on the person's education and their experience. There's no guarantee going forward that adjudicators will give deference to decisions that they've made in the past, for example, in determining whether a particular position is a high-skilled, involves or requires a high-skilled employee. So they've put additional evidentiary burdens on it and created a lot of uncertainty as to whether, again, visas that have been approved in the past will be approved going forward.
What about when we think how U.S. citizens are trying to get passports? Is that something that has also been caught up in this backlog, Cara?
Well, I think what you're pointing to is that there's certainly a lot of attention paid on undocumented individuals. However, even people with a status that are believed to be settled, such as U.S. citizenship, have also found themselves doubting whether or not they're really secure in this country. So there have been instances of U.S. citizens who have applied, for example, to renew passports, and not only have been denied passports, but have then had their underlying citizenship questioned, really throwing into doubt, again, their certainty in the United States.
There is criticism on one side with some of these changes that President Trump and his administration have put in place. But there's also this other side who have supported President Trump, who believe that there should be more limitations on who's able to come into this country. I mean, how do you respond to listeners who may be listening now who don't see a problem with these changes?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, first of all, our immigration enforcement policies have to be just. They have to be fair. They have to comport with our values of due process in the United States. And I think also in the processing of applications, it's important that they be processed in a fair and equitable way. So what feels incredibly unfair at times is when someone has submitted an application and all of a sudden the rules change midstream. The effects of having an application denied can also be changed. Another policy that has been announced and is being implemented piece by piece is referred to as a notice to appear policy. A notice to appear is a document that essentially begins removal proceedings. In the past, USCIS has had the authority to issue a notice to appear upon denying a document to someone. However, this new policy really takes that discretion away from them and directs them to issue these notices to appear. When it's determined that if a benefit is denied, that the person does not have authorization to remain in the U.S. So at the outset, someone may make a decision about whether it's really in this person's benefit or even in the benefit of a company to sponsor someone for an immigration benefit. But when the rules change midstream, again, it creates a lot of uncertainty and, in my opinion, great unfairness.
You can join our conversation as we talk more about the U.S. immigration system. The number 860-275-7266. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. When we think about the President Trump administration, again, lots of different policy changes coming down. But under President Obama, there was also increased enforcement and deportation proceedings. And I'm just wondering how you can compare and contrast what was done under the Obama administration to what we're seeing now with the Trump administration.
Well, you're right that under President Obama, we really had historically the highest numbers of removals or deportations in the United States. The difference, though, is that under the Obama administration, they had issued several memorandum or several policies that created thoughtful, targeted priorities for the people that would be removed from the United States. This falls under a doctrine of what's referred to as prosecutorial discretion. Whether it's criminal court or immigration court, government officials know they have limited resources to accomplish the work of their particular agency. And so in exercising prosecutorial discretion, they'll make choices about which types of cases will reap the greatest benefit to public safety. So for example, the Obama administration had set out very clear policies concerning who would be removed. So it could be people who pose a threat to national security, people with criminal convictions for violent crimes, people who had been previously removed from the United States. But what we saw shortly after the inauguration of President Trump was that he rescinded these policies and essentially sent the message that everybody's a priority. And when everybody's a priority, not only does everybody feel even more unsafe or insecure in the United States in their position. It's, again, it's hard to know whether or not our dollars are being used wisely to remove the people who really pose a threat to public safety.
What responsibility should Congress have when we think about our immigration system? Again, the term immigration reform has come up for decades now. There always seems to be an impasse on the types of actions that Congress wants to take. It's a give and take between the president and Congress. And I'm just curious, when we think about this idea of reforming our immigration system, what does that really look like? Is it attainable?
It's a large undertaking. I won't deny it. But I think in talking about what's referred to as comprehensive immigration reform, we realize that when you tinker with one part of the system, whether it's the benefits granting part or the enforcement part of the system, if you only look at that portion of it, you'll have unintended stresses and consequences in other areas. So for many years, what attorneys and advocates have promoted is a form of immigration that would really look not only at immigration enforcement, but also at future flows of individuals and possible paths to legalization for folks who are already here. It is difficult, but I think important.
You can join our conversation, 860-275-7266. My guest, Cara Hart, Associate Attorney for Leet, Costo and Wisner. Jennifer is calling from Madison. Jennifer, go ahead.
Hi. I was just wondering, Ms. Hart had commented on people who are supporting President Trump and his anti-immigrant policies. If she could speak to how or if immigrants who come to this country on the professional visas, how they might help U.S. citizens on the one hand. On the other hand, President Trump talks a lot about how the immigrants who come here are criminals. You know, are there any statistics or information about rate of criminality of U.S. citizens versus immigrants?
Good questions, Jennifer. Cara, did you want to respond?
Yes, I think studies show that immigrants commit crimes in far less frequently than native-born U.S. citizens. And as to your first question about how immigrants may contribute to the society in the U.S., in many instances, for example, in looking at employment-based immigration, in order for an employer to sponsor an immigrant for a permanent benefit for a green card, we have to prove that there are no qualified, eligible U.S. workers available to do that particular job. So we'll see, for example, businesses that, whether it's healthcare or manufacturing, who really come to rely on the skills and the expertise of immigrants in order to run their businesses, serve their U.S. customers, and support the local economy.
You can join our conversation again. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Here's the number, 860-275-7266. Coming up, we're going to learn more about the role of federal immigration courts and what's changed under the Trump administration. Also, more on how courts have been impacted by the federal government shutdown. And we want to hear from you, too. Have you had experience with our immigration system? How has it worked or not worked for you? Join us again, 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. We've been learning about several immigration policy changes that have happened under the Trump administration with my guest today, Cara Hart, a longtime immigration attorney who now practices with firm Leet, Costo and Wisner in Hartford. Now, we wanted to also give time for our listeners to ask questions about our fairly complicated immigration system. Also talk about your experiences. The number 860-275-7266. Max is calling from Southington. Max, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I'm an immigrant by myself, and I have an over 10 years of experience with the immigration system in the U.S. I came here as a highly skilled worker, L-1 visa. And, you know, over the years, what I experienced is that it's sometimes harder to be legal than illegal. When you are trying to renew your visa, you apply for the different processes, you visit offices. It just takes time. It's a waste of time from work, from life, costs money. And if you're illegal, it's mind-boggling, but you can still apply for like some benefits. And that is something where I think the focus of the reform should happen. And that people that are meant to be here in the country are being treated as welcomed. And, the ones that should not should have either a way to become legal or just leave. And, that's in my opinion, simple as that. An additional comment for, like, skilled workers. I work in a scientific field. And honestly, there's very minimum amount of the real Americans working in that field because most of the people were saying that, if you're good in physics, chemistry, math, just go for business because this is where the money is. And, you know, that's just my comment. Thank you very much.
Well, Max, thank you for your call. I wanted Kara Hart to respond. To the point of about undocumented immigrants getting benefits, that's something that comes up a lot in conversation. Tell us, what is the reality if someone comes in here, whether they are here on a legal visa or if they come to this country without legal status? What kind of benefits do they get, if at all?
I think typically, immigrants will qualify for no public benefits until they've actually achieved a permanent status, so permanent residency, for a period of 5 years. So I think there may be a perception that people are getting benefits, but the reality is, even after getting a green card, the wait can be 5 years to be eligible for any type of public benefit.
Do you think some of the reasons people think about what immigrants are getting, whether they are here legally or not, relates to how federal law gives certain protections and access to, say, an education, or if you go to a hospital, you're able to still get health care?
Well, I would qualify that if you go to a hospital, you may be only eligible for emergency Medicaid for a life-threatening condition. So, for example, a pregnant woman, would not be qualified for prenatal care, but may be able to receive emergency Medicaid at the time of delivery of a child. So I do think there are tremendous misperceptions out there about what's available.
Max also mentioned that he came to this country on a high-skilled visa, and the perception that it's easier for someone who's undocumented to come to this country. What is the reality in terms of someone who is on a high-skilled visa to be able to go through the system? I think we talked about in the aid that there is a backlog because of changes that have happened.
Right. The reality is there are very few paths to permanent residency for people, whether they're in temporary status like a student or a skilled worker. In general, I'll say to people that our immigration system works a lot like a private club, and that in order to join our club, you have to be sponsored by someone who is already a member. So it could be through employment. It could be through a family member. But it is an exceptionally difficult process, and the person's immigration history will also have an impact on whether or not they'll ever achieve that permanent benefit. Every one of those visa categories, ADU, now I think we're up to UV, has its own requirements, and it has its own limitations, and not all of those allow the person to basically adjust from one status to a permanent status. So it is complicated.
Kara Hart is my guest today, Associate Attorney for Leet, Costo & Wisner, as we talk about our U.S. immigration system, trying to focus a little away from the conversation debate that is continuing on whether or not there should be a border wall, but talking about changes that have happened within our immigration system and the impact. You can join our conversation, 860-275-7266. There are federal courthouses like the one on Main Street in downtown Hartford that handle immigration matters, everything from citizenship ceremonies to deportation proceedings. We were wondering how courts have been affected by policy changes related to immigration over the last 2 years. So joining me now in studio is John Bauer, a clinical professor of law at UConn Law School. He also directs the Asylum and Human Rights Clinic there. John, welcome back to our show.
It's great to be here again. And good morning, Lucy and Kara. Happy to join you.
So tell us more about the immigration court system. How do you break that down for our listeners who may not be familiar with the way the system operates?
Okay. So the immigration courts are judges appointed by the Attorney General of the United States. They work for the Justice Department, and their job is to adjudicate removal cases, or what's commonly called deportation cases, cases where the government has sought to remove someone. It might be someone who lacks legal status. It might be someone who was a permanent resident but has done something that the government claims makes them deportable. And the immigration judges have to apply very complicated laws to decide whether the government has in fact shown that the person is removable. And in many cases, they have to decide claims for relief from removal that people may have. It might be based on a marriage to a U.S. citizen, which could give them a right to a green card. It might be a claim for asylum for someone who fears persecution in their home country. So they have a very difficult job, and unfortunately, this administration has been making it more difficult.
So tell us more about how it's become more difficult.
Well, the shutdown, for one thing, has resulted in, as of the end of this week, it will be nationwide, 108,000 hearings in immigration court will have been canceled. And it should be about 600 case cancellations in the Hartford Immigration Court alone. Hartford is one of 61 immigration courts around the country. It has two full-time judges. Most of the judges already have a pending caseload of 4,000 or 5,000 cases. And as a result, they're scheduling cases out until 2021 or 2022. So there are already long delays in having these cases heard, which is bad both for the government in terms of enforcing immigration laws against people who have no defense, and it's bad for people who do have a legitimate claim to asylum or other kinds of immigration relief.
Did you say that one particular immigration judge has a caseload of 4,000 cases?
Yes, that's the average for immigration judges around the country.
And when we think about the federal shutdown for the immigration hearings that have been postponed, maybe someone's been waiting for several months or years to finally have their time before a judge. What does that mean in terms of how much longer they'll have to wait once the government reopens?
Many people will essentially go to the back of the line again. If their cases were canceled, they will get the next available date for a full-scale hearing, which is likely to be 3 years away. So you may have someone who has a very strong claim for legal status who's left in limbo for another 3 years.
So I'm just curious when we think about, again, this idea of being in limbo. Say somebody has a deportation order and they're trying to get a stay of removal, the permission to stay maybe another year or so. If that is delayed in the meantime, could an agency like ICE come and deport someone, or do they still have that ability to see a judge before that happens, John?
Someone would have the ability to seek a stay of deportation. But in terms of the final hearing that would decide whether they have the right to remain in the United States, that is going to be long delayed. And I think it's important to bear in mind that a lot of the backlog problem is the result of policies pursued by this administration. The backlog has risen 50% since President Trump took office, despite a 30% increase in the number of immigration judges. And there have been a number of policy changes. Kara has talked about some of them, including ending prosecutorial discretion. As a result, ICE is flooding the system with new cases. And the Attorney General has taken away from immigration judges sensible case management tools that they used to use. They used to be able to administratively close cases where, over the course of time, the person is likely to get the ability to stay in the United States through an immigration application that they're pursuing. So it used to be the case that immigration judges could close out low priority cases, cases where the person ultimately probably has a good claim to stay. No longer. That's the end of administrative closure has put about 300,000 cases back on the active docket of the immigration courts. So it's a real problem.
John Bauer is with us, clinical professor of law at UConn Law School, also directs the Asylum and Human Rights Clinic there. He's on Where We Live as we talk about our U.S. immigration system, specifically talking about our federal immigration courts and how there is a backlog, also exacerbated now by this shutdown. You can join our conversation, 860-275-7266. Kara Hart is with us, who's an immigration attorney with Leet, Costo & Wisner. We heard John talk about there have actually been more immigration judges, a 30% increase within the system. But what does that mean in terms of further implications with how these cases are going to be heard? Or would you rather talk about this, John? Again, there is an increase, and President Trump wants to see more immigration judges, but the backlog is still pretty extreme.
It is. And there's another problem that's become really critical, which is the lack of independence of immigration judges. The immigration judges are, as I said, appointed by the Attorney General. They work for the Justice Department, and they're treated by the Justice Department as staff attorneys who are expected to carry out administration policy rather than independent judges. It's as if criminal court judges were appointed by and accountable to the chief prosecutor. That's not a way to run a system that's fair and neutrally applies the law. And there's a lot of pressure from the Attorney General now on immigration judges to decide cases a certain way. In a speech to immigration judges, former Attorney General Sessions told them that asylum is a loophole and that most asylum cases lack merit and are concocted by dirty immigration lawyers. That's an exact quote from the Attorney General. He issued a decision telling immigration judges that in general, victims of domestic violence and people threatened by gangs should not be granted asylum, rather than telling them to neutrally apply legal principles and to consider the facts of each individual case. There have been proposals to create an independent immigration court. It's been something called an Article I court, like the tax court or the bankruptcy court, to make it independent of the Justice Department so that judges are free to decide cases fairly without outside interference. The Union of Immigration Judges has strongly supported that, as have the American Bar Association and the Federal Bar Association. So there's a real need for structural reform in the immigration courts.
When we think about our congressional delegation, John, some of the concerns and issues that are popping up within the system, is that being addressed by our congressional delegation?
Our congressional delegation, through their staff in Connecticut, does a tremendous job of working with individuals who have run into problems in dealing with the immigration bureaucracy. So often they can troubleshoot applications that have gotten lost in the system. I think across the board, our congressional delegation in both the House and the Senate are strong advocates of comprehensive immigration reform in ways that would both beef up enforcement where that's needed and offer a path to legalization and citizenship for people who have been in the United States for a long time.
There's been a lot of attention on the border wall costing more than $5 billion. How much funding would it cost to make the immigration court system more robust to handle these cases, John? Not to put you on the spot.
There's a need for more immigration judges, and I think Congress is ready to appropriate money for more immigration judges. But more immigration judges alone isn't the answer. The system needs to be rationalized. The immigration judges need to, again, be able to use case management tools that they used in the past, like being able to prioritize cases, close out low priority cases, and focus on the most pressing issues. I think without cost, a lot can be done to improve the system. And Congress is ready to spend money to increase the number of immigration judges.
What has that done to morale within the immigration system, from the judges to the immigration attorneys that are there representing their clients?
I don't want to speak for them, but
Cara, can you talk about the system?
Well, I understand from reports that morale, even among immigration judges, coming from their union reports, is that they're definitely feeling the pressure. They've also had imposed on them case quotas as part of their performance measures. So not only are they facing, you know, crushing numbers of cases, they're being pressured to decide them more quickly.
Just to elaborate on that, they've been told they should close out 700 cases a year. And the only way to do that, you know, in many cases, would be to not give people full hearings and just become like a deportation machine. And judges don't want to do that. They want to afford due process. But they're facing a lot of pressure from, and that's why they need independence from the Justice Department.
We're talking about changes within the U.S. immigration system over the last 2 years with the change to the Trump administration. You can join our conversation here on Where We Live, 860-275-7266. My guest today, Cara Hart, Associate Attorney for Leet, Costo & Wisner. Also, John Bauer, Clinical Professor of Law at UConn Law School. Catherine's calling from Orange. Catherine, go ahead with your question or comment. Catherine, are you there? Nope. I don't think Catherine can hear me. But in terms of what we've been discussing moving forward, again, so much attention on whether or not there should be a border wall. I'm just curious what your thoughts are in how this can be moved forward to the benefit of the system and the people that are trying to get the process through, because we keep hearing so often about comprehensive immigration reform needing to happen. But I'm just curious in terms of the next steps, like how can we get there? Cara, I'll start with you.
It's a difficult question. I think, first of all, the government needs to reopen. Really, nothing can move forward without that happening first. Most of the policy changes, really all of the policy changes that we have been talking about have happened at an agency level. So without Congress acting, the agencies have made sweeping decisions about how they will interpret laws and how they will carry out their functions. So until Congress acts, I think this is what we can expect to see, that the agencies will continue to sort of carry the ball and make decisions for better or for worse.
Well, I want to thank Cara Hart for joining us today for some perspective of how the system is working. Cara, thank you.
Thank you.
Also, I want to thank John Bauer, clinical professor of law at UConn Law School, talking specifically about our federal immigration courts. John, thanks for seeing you.
Thank you, Lucy.
Coming up, despite political rhetoric and changes to immigration policy on the federal level, how do local towns and cities respond to residents who are new immigrants? We're going to speak with a Trinity College professor who's written a book on that issue. That's right after the break. You can join us, too. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. You've heard the term sanctuary cities when referring to places like New Haven and Hartford, Connecticut, to San Francisco, California. These municipalities have policies that limit local police from enforcing federal immigration laws. But beyond law enforcement, how do local governments take cues or ignore the federal government when it comes to the way cities and towns respond to their immigrant residents? My next guest has researched this question and more. I want to welcome to the show Abigail Fisher-Williamson, Associate Professor of Political Science and Public Policy and Law at Trinity College. She's author of the book Welcoming New Americans, Local Governments and Immigrant Incorporation. Also, she co-edited The Politics of New Immigrant Destinations. Abby, welcome to our show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So in your book, you look into specific areas of the country that have put in policies starting way back in the 1990s to respond to new residents, immigrants who have come in to their towns or cities. Is this something that is specific to liberal cities, or are we seeing this also in conservative areas of the country?
Sure. What I argue in the book is that this is actually something much more pervasive, so that local governments actually tend towards welcoming policies. So in the book, I do a couple of things. So I started out back in actually 2003 visiting four new immigrant destinations. So these are places where you might think you might have seen the most restrictive responses to immigrants. They were places that had no experience dealing with linguistically different populations, no experience dealing with immigrants in general. And what I was finding in these places was it wasn't the case. I was actually seeing more welcoming responses in these places than I would have expected. So then I went on, after observing these places over a period of years, to do a national survey of local government officials across the entire country in both 2014 and in 2016. And what I found was not just large liberal cities, but a random sample of places that were greater than 5,000 in population, at least 5% foreign-born. If you look at those places, four in five of them are implementing some welcoming policies. only one in five of them had implemented any sort of restrictive practice.
When you talk about welcoming policies, what do you mean?
Sure. Well, I should first say, when I say policies, usually these things aren't sort of formal ordinances. So these are more sort of informal practices, which might slip below the radar, particularly in our current political environment with some heated rhetoric over immigration. So the three sort of main things that I see local governments doing, the first is really engaging with immigrant communities, and that can happen in a variety of ways. One is pretty simple. So, for instance, hosting events or sponsoring events that celebrate diversity or promote intercultural interactions. So I saw this happening in Lewiston, Maine, where there's a new Somali population there. And the local government tried to find low-cost ways that they could sort of encourage interaction and encourage the community to come together to support the newcomers. And so what they did was they hired Vista volunteers. And these Vista volunteers held new neighbor nights that really brought the local communities together. So that's one thing I see, this sort of engaging with immigrant communities. Another very prominent response is including immigrants in decision-making. And I saw this both across the four cities that I looked at, and I also see that it happens in nearly half of the immigrant destinations that I surveyed. So, for instance, appointing immigrants to local boards and commissions or even to vacant elected positions. And then lastly, of course, providing services to immigrants. And the most common way that this happens is through partnering with a local immigrant organization. So Wausau, Wisconsin, which is one of the cities that I studied, the local government partnered with what's now known as the Hmong American Center to make sure that Hmong refugees were provided with services ways that were able to help their community advance.
You mentioned the heated rhetoric happening in the country, and again, it focuses often on undocumented immigrants and the types of assistance they may be taking from citizens in our country. But when we think about how local municipalities respond to their residents, whether immigrant or native-born, when they think about immigrants, what's the first thing they think about as their contribution? Is it based on what their economic contribution will be, and that's why it's important to help them integrate?
So it depends on whether you're talking about local officials or local residents.
Let's start with the officials.
Okay. So the challenge is that often local officials have quite different incentives from local residents, and that's why I make that distinction. What I find in my book is that local officials, for a couple of reasons, have incentives to support immigrants. They both have legal and economic incentives. So in terms of the economic, they really see immigrants as contributors. They see them as workers. They see them as consumers. They see them as entrepreneurs. And that's in part because local officials are very constrained fiscally. Unlike state and federal government, they don't have as many opportunities to raise taxes. And so they're really looking for innovative ways to do economic development. And as a result, they really see the opportunities that immigrants bring. So they really first see them as contributors. And then secondarily, there are some longstanding signals from the federal government that tell local officials that immigrants are their clients. So for instance, local governments are required to serve immigrants in K-12 schools, providing English language learning services, and also under civil rights laws, they're required to provide language access in providing municipal services if they have a significant language minority population. So that sort of sends a signal to local governments that immigrants are your clients. So local officials themselves end up seeing immigrants as contributors and clients.
You touched on the difference between the local officials and the local residents. So let's talk about that. There is, as you noticed in some of the municipalities that you profiled and researched, that there can be a division between how local residents interpret these new immigrants coming in. Can you talk a little bit about some of the reasons why?
Absolutely. So whereas local officials have these incentives that cause them to see immigrants have these sort of positive associations with immigrants as contributors, as clients, local residents don't necessarily have that as their first touch point when they think of immigrants. And in fact, given the heated rhetoric at the national level, as you said before, the first thing that comes to people's heads might be about unauthorized status. I was recently reading that actually a majority of Americans believes that most immigrants are here in undocumented status, and that's simply not the case. If anything, it's a little bit more than a quarter of immigrants. And so the local residents have quite different images of immigrants in their heads. And as a result, when they see local government officials providing services to immigrants, at times this can result in a backlash. Local residents can feel as though local officials are providing some sort of preferential treatment.
We have some data from the Pew Center that finds there were 10.7 million unauthorized immigrants in the U.S. in 2016, representing 3% of the total U.S. population.
Yes.
When we think about some of, again, the debate happening in Washington about the immigration policy, I'm just curious how that then trickles down into particular communities that you've profiled and how that has maybe exacerbated these tensions between local residents and new immigrants. I think Lewiston, Maine was one of the examples.
Absolutely. So there's a pretty concrete example from Lewiston, actually. So when President Trump was on the campaign trail, he went to Portland, Maine, and gave a public address. And in that address, he made claims, which are not factually true, about immigrants being more likely to commit crimes. And then he went on to say, in particular, Maine knows about this because of their Somali population. And in fact, in Lewiston, since the Somali population arrived, crime has fallen quite substantially, actually. And so sort of an interesting thing happened in Lewiston. One is that most local officials, including the mayor, who at times has not been the most supportive of the local Somali population, spoke out against President Trump's comments and said, we don't have a problem here with Somali refugees. At the same time, though, residents might be more susceptible to those messages. And indeed, President Trump did end up winning the Androscoggin County, which had long been a Democratic stronghold.
When we hear President Trump threatening to take away federal funding for so-called sanctuary cities, does that kind of threat have teeth? Has it happened? And as you do your research, are you noticing more municipalities that are becoming more restrictive because they're taking cues from the federal government?
Yeah, it's a great question. So far that threat has not had teeth. San Francisco and Santa Clara County successfully sued to stay most of the revocation of funding that President Trump had attempted to achieve in his executive order. And most recently, there was still one law enforcement grant that was being denied from sanctuary cities. And Philadelphia sued successfully, and they have now received that law enforcement grant. So in terms of the actual what's actually happened with that, thus far, there has not been teeth. At the same time, though, it's a little bit more of a complicated picture. So when I look at sanctuary cities nationwide, I find that thus far they have not reined in restrictions. So I looked at sort of a random sample of sanctuary cities that I gathered from various sources. And what I found was that actually two-thirds of them had enacted or affirmed their policies after Trump was on the campaign trail and elected. And there were only 6% that had taken any steps to disavow or scale back the policy. So that suggests that these sort of sanctuary policies will go forward, but we also see an increased county-level interest in being involved in federal immigration enforcement. So it's a little bit of a mixed bag.
I should mention that even the city of Springfield, Massachusetts, they tried to pass an ordinance to make Springfield a quote-unquote sanctuary city. The mayor there, Dominic Sarno, actually vetoed that, and the Springfield City Council ultimately overrode it, again, to make this point that they want to be welcoming to all residents. What do you make of that situation with just about a couple minutes left?
Absolutely. I think Springfield is actually a really good example. So it sort of indicates the ambivalence that local officials can feel on these issues, particularly when you have a president who is threatening funding for cities that want to not be involved in local immigration enforcement. But I think that the what I see in Springfield sort of resonates with the argument of my book, in that even though there was sort of this restrictive episode in which the mayor came out and vetoed the city council's efforts, the city council overrode it. And that makes sense because we would expect places that what I see in my book is that places that are a little bit larger and have more capacity to serve immigrants, so like Springfield, are going to be more likely to be welcoming. Places in which immigrants are more visible are more likely to be more welcoming. And in Springfield, 10% of the population is foreign-born. And then also in places where the surrounding policy environment is more favorable. So even though we have sort of a restrictive federal policy environment, the policy environment in Massachusetts would be sort of more favorable.
We have to leave it there. Abigail Fisher-Williamson, again, Associate Professor of Political Science and Public Policy and Law at Trinity College. A really interesting book, author of Welcoming New Americans, Local Governments and Immigrant Incorporation. Abby, thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me.
Today's show produced by Senior Producer Lydia Brown. A special thanks to Herman Baskoff and our technical producer, Kion Wolf. Learn more about the show at wmpr.org/where we live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel. As always, thanks for listening.